Good evening. My name is Jason Mack. I work here at First Baptist Church, and on behalf of everyone here at First Baptist Church, I want to say welcome. I'm really excited about tonight's conversation. Like I said earlier, I've been in ministry for 10 years now and a Christian for a little bit longer than that, and often when I find that there's something I'm struggling with, either in my work or in my own faith, that I can turn to this guy, Brian McLaren, and he's often written something about it or blogged something about it. And one of the issues, I'm the minister of community here at First Baptist. So what that means for us is I coordinate events that try to bring us together as a community and try to reach out to the community outside the walls. And when I'm doing that work of reaching out to the community outside the walls and I'm talking to people about faith, there are two questions that I find are stumbling blocks for people who are interested in faith but aren't part. And the first is, why do bad things happen? And we're not going to deal with that one tonight. Maybe a different conversation. And the second one is, what about people of other faiths? If I was to join a particular faith group, what would that mean? How would my attitude then have to be towards people of other faiths? And I don't know that that is a question that as a church we often have a very good answer for. So I'm excited to welcome you to what I hope will be the inaugural Doris Wiedemann Memorial Peace Fund lecture. This one by Brian McLaren on why did Jesus, Moses, the Buddha, and Muhammad cross the road.
I've had a really nice day here with y'all. For those of you who weren't here earlier, I live in Southwest Florida, and to be up here and say that means a lot, you know. I've really felt at home. I've met such wonderful people. And I'm especially happy tonight. I've heard the talk I'm going to give you before, so, you know, it's okay. But I'm really excited because we've got this panel later on. I'm looking forward to meeting some people and having some discussion. I have a friend who says one of our big jobs in life is to figure out what's ours to do. And 6 or 8 years ago, I started thinking, someday I'm going to have to write a book on religious identity, pluralism, and those sort of issues. And I kind of wished it was somebody else's to do. But I just, as time went on, I felt it really was mine to do. And when I wrote the book, I just felt very much that I was in the groove of what the Spirit had for me to do. When I was writing the book, people said, oh, I hear you're writing an interfaith book. And I would always say, yeah, sort of. But really, I was writing a Christian identity book. I was writing a book primarily for Christians. Now, I'm very happy to say that since the book has come out, I hear from a lot of Muslims and Hindus and Buddhists and Jews and atheists, people from many different backgrounds who say, hey, I read your book. The first thing they say is, it's nice to see Christians dealing with their issues, you know? Like we've known about them for so long, and it's nice that you're, you know, beginning to recognize them, and we can tell you a little more when you're ready, you know? But also then to say, and we have issues of our own, because we're living at a very, very critical time. A lot of our history really, most of us don't even know this, but a lot of our history grows out of something called the 30 Years' War. From 1618 to 1648, Europe was torn apart by a series of battles that in some ways were the battles between Protestants and Catholics. A lot of folks look at what's going on in the Islamic world today, a struggle between Sunni influence and Shiite influence, and struggles within the Sunni community for different factions with more or less influence and more and less ironic ways of holding Islamic doctrine and tradition and identity. And they say, boy, this is a lot like what Christians went through in the early 17th century. 1618 to 1648, parts of southern Germany, 50% of the population died because of wars that had a large religious component to them. Protestants and Catholics killing each other. And a lot of the people dying were men, women, and children dying from starvation and disease because the men were so busy fighting battles that nobody planted the crops. And people literally ran out of food. And of course, if you, as Americans, we think 1776, and we go back and think, what were the conditions that led to people wanting to establish a nation that had separation of church and state? Can you see how there's a relationship there? All that's to say, we've got some work to do on our identity. I remember the day after September 11, 2001, I lived for many years in Washington, D.C., and I lived north of Washington, but you could take like three turns and go to the end of a street, and I could see the plume of smoke coming up from the Pentagon. And a lot of the people in the congregation that I pastored were on antibiotics in the weeks after from the anthrax scare. I don't know if that got on your radar up here, but it was a big deal for us. It just felt like the world was falling apart. And there was a press conference going on the radio, and, you know, they were just broadcasting news all the time. And I wish I'd written this down, but I didn't realize how important it was. But there was a general, and who did this? And we think it might have been Al-Qaeda. And then a reporter says, do you have parts of the military that study Islam? And the general laughed as if, what a ridiculous question. He said, we don't study religion. We're in the military, you know, business. Of course, now people would laugh at that naivete. We realize that in our world, well, here's one way to say it. The reason I wrote about this as Christian identity in a multi-faith world is because the Christian religion has the history of the most violence of any world religion. We're the most well-armed religion in the history of history, and the richest. Christians make up about 33% of the world's population, very loosely speaking. Muslims make up 24%. If Christians and Muslims can't get along, over half the world is in turmoil and everybody's in danger. So we live at a time where we've got some work to do, and we've got to decide, do people have to get rid of their faith in order to have peace? Or is there a way for there to be peace among passionately faithful people? And that's what was behind the book. Now, we really struggled with the title. And some of you would say you should have struggled a little longer. We wanted something that had some amount of humor to it. So we sort of worked off the old chicken and the egg joke. To give you an idea of what a boring life I have, I did research on this joke. I mean, it's sort of sad when you have to research a joke. But it turns out that this joke is an example of anti-humor. And anti-humor is when you set up the conventions of a joke and people expect you to say something funny and then you don't say anything funny. And it's funny, but only once. Because after that, it's not funny anymore. So then you have to start doing riffs on the not funny, formerly funny example of anti-humor. And there are a lot of riffs on the old chicken joke, some of them sad, some of them really sad. You know, why? Why did chicken cross the road? My favorite, two stupid chickens. How do I get to the other side? You are on the other side. By the way, if you've ever been mystified by the meaning of the word postmodern, that's it. And I started collecting new riffs on the old joke. Why did chicken cross the road? It's Albert Einstein. Did the chicken really cross the road, or did the road move beneath the chicken? So Isaac Newton, chickens at rest tend to stay at rest. Chickens in motion. The nun said it was a habit. Hamlet said, that is not the question. John Donne said, it crosseth for thee. And my personal favorite, Colonel Sanders said, did I miss one? I was telling some people that I grew up in a fundamentalist church background. And so one of the riffs is, why did the dinosaur cross the road? And there are two answers to this. One is suitable for fundamentalist audiences like mine, and that is that it was the chicken's day off. Why did the dinosaur cross the road? But the other one that we could never have told, because we wouldn't be allowed to laugh at this, is because the chicken had not yet evolved. But that's another. And then what is the chicken's deepest dream? To cross the road without anyone questioning his motives. And I think Wisconsin people will still get this. Why did the Texas chicken cross the road? To prove to the armadillos that it could be done. And then, of course, why did the chicken go to the seance? I don't even need to tell you. To get to the other side. So, but we wanted to set up something with a little bit of humor because religious people can get deadly serious. I was a pastor for 24 years. I did a lot of marriage counseling. And one of the things I learned is that if you're doing marriage counseling and you have a couple who comes and sits in front of you and they are really, really serious, things will not go well. Like there's this excessive seriousness that makes everything just go downhill. So sometimes what you have to do with a couple is you've got to get them to laugh at themselves a little bit, you know. And I think in our religious communities, we could use a little less seriousness sometimes. It's why in almost every religious community, there is a tradition of a certain kind of religious joke, which is a way to say we'd better not take ourselves too seriously when we're dealing with our most serious subject. We also wanted to convey the idea of our religious leaders doing something together, crossing a road together. Because just about everybody who knows anything about any of our great religious leaders knows that they would have treated one another better than their followers tend to do. Have you ever thought about, I mean, obviously Jesus was constantly getting in trouble for showing more kindness to people who were different than his associates thought he should. Even his disciples kept getting mad at him for the uncommon interest and respect he would pay to people who were supposed to be considered other and them. Have you ever thought about Moses? Talk about a person with conflicted religious identity syndrome. Moses is born the son of Hebrew slaves, adopted and raised by Egyptian slave masters, comes of age and has to decide, as many bicultural people do, which culture he'll identify with as an adult. When he makes his choice, both sides reject him. And then he has to flee, where he goes out to a third culture and marries a girl who's a preacher's kid of yet another religion. And that father, the priest of yet another religion, his father-in-law ends up giving him some career counseling that saves his skin. So Moses lives in the nexus of three different religious and cultural traditions. The Buddha, if you know anything about the Buddha, he's associated with compassion and not harming other sentient beings. He wasn't really big on raising armies and conquering his enemies, right? Muhammad. You know, I feel so, after really being involved in this kind of work for many years now, I feel so sad for Christians who've only heard a jaded cartoon caricature of Muhammad. He is a fascinating human being. If you learn about his biography, if you just look at him as a historical figure, a fascinating human being. I was having dinner with a Muslim friend last year, and he said, Brian, there's a story you should know. Almost all Muslims know this story. It's not in the Quran, but it's one of the traditional stories about Muhammad. And a lot of Christians don't know this either, that when Muhammad was alive, there were Roman Catholic Christians in Arabia, and there were Syrian Christians, if you know your church history, they had followed Arius and they were considered damnable heretics by the Roman Catholic Christians. And Muhammad was friends with both the warring Christians. So, you know, some things never change. And there were Jews and of course, but the majority of Arabians themselves were a whole range of what we would call polytheistic tribes, with each with their own religion. And so Muhammad invited a group of Roman Catholic Christian theologians to come and meet with him and some of the early of his early followers to have a discussion about the doctrine of the Trinity. Because Muhammad believed in the God of Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, and Joseph. He believed in the Bible. He believed in, loved Jesus. Jesus was the greatest prophet. But he didn't agree with the Roman Catholic Christians about the doctrine of the Trinity. By the way, Muhammad deeply believed in the virgin birth, but so he had more in common with the Arian Christians. So he was having a respectful discussion. And this Christian bishop and some of his scholars came and they talked for the morning. A lot of Christians today don't know that back in those days, Christians used to pray five times a day. They weren't on the same time zone as the Muslims, but they prayed five times. It's something to remember tonight when the times change. So it came to midday, and the Christian leader said, "Excuse us, it's our hour of prayer. We'll just go out in the field there, and we'll have our prayers, and we'll be back in a little while." And Muhammad said, "I built a mosque right here. Don't go out in the hot sun. Go into my mosque. You can pray in there." So the Christians file into the mosque to have their midday prayers, and Muhammad's associates get upset with him. "Why did you let those heretics who believe in three deities go into our church, our mosque, where we only believe in one?" And Muhammad's like, "You know, I'm paraphrasing, but dudes, you know, they're praying, you know." And so my Muslim friend told me this story. He says almost all Muslims know this story. A few months later, someone came up to me and said, "Well, there's another story that goes after that one." And he said, a century or two later, there was a Muslim general who was conquering a section of the Middle East. And there was a village that was populated with Christians. And when this general conquered the area, the Christians sent a message to the general saying, "When you come to our city, you are welcome to pray in our church." Do you get it? And so the general came to the city and he did not pray in their church. And they were very concerned. So they sent a letter by an envoy to the general to say, "Why didn't you pray in our church?" He said, "No offense intended. I was worried that if I prayed in your church, my people would turn it into a mosque, and I didn't want that to happen to you. So I stayed away so that you can continue to be Christians without interference of my fellow Muslims." You see, so there's this history. In our traditions, we've gotten along with each other way better, and we could be quite certain that our leaders would treat each other better than we often treat each other. Now, my starting point in this project was this, that we Christians, now, again, I wouldn't expect everybody here. I'm sure we've got people, many different religious backgrounds, but among people like myself who identify as Christians, we know how to do two things very well already. We're really good at these two things. First one is we know how to have a strong Christian identity that's hostile toward people of other religions. Now, we usually don't think we're hostile. We just think we're faithful. But my next door neighbor really helped me see this, where I used to live, a wonderful Jewish lady. And one day I was running out to my car and I was late as usual, and she called out, "Hey, Brian, I need to talk to you." I said, "I'm really running late." She says, "I need 5 minutes." I said, "What's up?" She said, "I was listening to Christian radio this morning." I said, "Eileen, why do you do that? I don't even do that. It makes me so mad." She said, "It was not for inspiration, but surveillance purposes." She said, "And I heard a couple of preachers say, we're going to take this country back for Jesus." And she just got this twang that just sounded like some preachers I'd heard. She said, "What is that supposed to mean to a Jewish mother? We're going to take this country back for Jesus. Is that an invitation for me to move to Canada?" You know, I'm sure the preachers who said that had no idea how scary and hostile that sounded to a person who happens to tune their radio to that station without, you know, knowing what they're getting into. And so we have people who identify as committed Christians, and they have no idea how hostile what they say and how they think feels and sounds to people of other religious traditions. And many Christians would say, yeah, I don't want to be hostile, but in order to be faithful, these are the kinds of things I have to say. Now, we have other people, and I'm going to guess a lot of us in this room, we are sure we don't want to sound like these people. So we have other people who know how to have what I would call a weak Christian identity that is tolerant or benign toward people of other faiths. In other words, we say, look, I don't want to be one of those hostile Christians, so I'm going to kind of downplay my Christianity so I don't have to be such a jerk. That's a theological term, by the way. And kind of what they might say is something like this. Even if they don't say it overtly, it works like this. Look, I know you're an atheist. I know I'm a Christian. But we can be friends because my religion isn't that important to me, right? Or, so we have this idea that we have to decaffeinate or dilute our faith in order to make it less offensive to people of other faiths. And we know what people sound like who say this. In fact, when I've given this talk before, I've almost always had people come and say, well, you messed me up. I used to be in the first category. Then I was in the second category. And the reason we say these sorts of things is because we're trying to figure out a way to not be hostile toward people of other religious identities. It of course, leaves a third alternative. Is it possible to imagine there could be a strong Christian identity that is benevolent toward other religions, not just tolerant, but benevolent? Could we imagine a person saying, because I am a committed Christian, I love and respect people of all religions, and I find what is admirable and good to the best of my ability in every religious tradition? Could we imagine that kind of identity? What would that look like? What would that sound like? And why does it seem often that it is so hard to find? So that was really my project. And you know that weak, what I'm calling a weak and tolerant Christian identity, often the way it works is like this. We say, I don't want to offend people who have different doctrines or beliefs or practices, so I'm going to suppress the distinctiveness of my own faith. I got to see this some years ago. Have any of you heard of the Common Word document? Does that ring a bell? I'm not talking about like Microsoft. So do you remember a few years ago when the previous pope said some insulting things about Islam and about Muhammad in a speech in Regensburg, Germany? It got a lot of publicity. Well, a group of, I believe it was 38 Muslim scholars got together and they said, look, if a Danish cartoonist can get people rioting in the streets, a pope can really cause some trouble. So they wrote a very cordial letter to the Vatican and they said, we represent a whole wide range of Muslim different. A lot of Christians don't realize that Muslims have denominations too, and different denominations in Islam. And they said, and we would like to talk. Could we talk to each other so that we can more respectfully talk about each other and avoid conflict? And they waited a couple months, no response. Waited a year, no response. And they thought, well, maybe we're not going to hear back from the Vatican. So then they got an even larger group of Muslim scholars together and they wrote a larger document that was called A Common Word Between Us and You, addressed to the Christians of the world. And here's what it said. Basically, I'm paraphrasing and summing up. They said, you Christians believe Jesus is the Son of God. We Muslims believe Jesus was a prophet. Jesus taught the greatest commandment is to love God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength. Love your neighbors yourself. On this, we both agree. So based on this teaching of Jesus, if we're to love one another as neighbors, then we ought to talk to each other. And we're asking that we could start some serious dialogue between Christians and Muslims. And I was honored to be invited to be among the first group of signatories to a response letter from a wide range of Christians. And that led to some gatherings where we got together. And this was the first large gathering, and I was able to attend. But I arrived late after all the introductions happened. You know, they went around and introduced everybody introduced themselves. So when I got there, I was introduced just very briefly by somebody who I was listed in 2005 in Time magazine as one of the 25 most influential evangelicals. A lot of evangelicals were very upset about that. They for a whole lot of reasons. But at any rate, I got introduced as, this is Brian McLaren. He's Time magazine says he's, you know, blah, blah, blah. So later on in the event, they broke us into small groups for more intimate discussion. And I turned out to be in a group that was all Muslims. I was the only Christian in the group. And when I sat down in my group, one of the guys said, "Oh, good, we got the evangelical." And I said, "Well, I need to tell you my credentials are under review, you know." But I said, why would you say that? He said, when we're around liberal Protestants, they're so polite, they don't want to offend us. So they will never say that they actually believe anything because they don't want to offend us. But that puts us in the awkward position of having to act like we're being rude if we stand up for what we believe. But when we're with evangelicals, they just tell us we're going to hell. And because we're not born again Christians. And then we get that on the table and we're free to disagree. It's actually nicer to be free to disagree than have to pretend you agree. Can you all see that? How they felt that way? So he said, so that's why, you know, we were glad to get you on in our group. See, there's this belief that our differences are our problem is widespread. So we have to suppress difference. That creates a whole set of problems. We could talk about it later if you want. My conviction, after doing the research for this book, I'm so convinced of this. Our greatest problem is not our religious differences. Our greatest problem is the one thing that all religions have in common. You know, people say all religions are the same. In this way, that's exactly the problem. Because the way that we're the same is that we build a strong religious identity among us through hostility toward them. It happens across religious communities. Nobody described it better than the brilliant Catholic theologian James Allison, who said, "Give people a common enemy and you will give them a common identity. Deprive them of an enemy and you will deprive them of the crutch by which they know who they are." Now, I know in today's political world, we can't imagine such a thing. But a lot of anthropologists and psychologists point out how probably this kind of tribal hostility had survival value in our ancient past. Since all of us are the descendants of hunter-gatherers 40, 60, 100,000 years ago, those hunter-gatherers lived in tribes. And in order to survive, the tribe had to defend an amount of land sufficient to sustain herbivores and carnivores and fruit trees and the grasses and all the rest. If you couldn't defend enough land and keep it available, then your children would starve to death. So it really was important. And can you see why having tribal markers, paint or feathers, whatever, so you know who's in your tribe and who's not, that's necessary for survival. And all of us wouldn't be here if some of our tribal ancestors hadn't successfully maintained hostility toward others to keep them off their land. Does that make sense? And it probably helps explain why, you know, some 100,000 years ago, a lot of our ancestors came up out of Africa, and some of them took a left turn and populated Europe, and some took a right turn and populated India, and some went down to Australia, and some worked their way north. And because each group of hunter-gatherers would have to stake out enough land to survive. And they'd have to push other tribes farther and farther away. And that results in, eventually, people crossing the Bering Strait and working their way down to Tierra del Fuego. And, you know, and the Earth being a sphere, it was inevitable that eventually we'd meet each other and we'd have to get along. We can't just push people farther out anymore. Robert Wright said it this way: historically, the amity or goodwill within the group has often depended on enmity or hatred between groups. But when you get to the global level, and especially when you add biological, chemical, and nuclear weapons to the mix, That won't work. And so now it's almost as if, in an evolutionary sense, our species has to find another way to build identity without hostility toward the other. Could there be a kind of strong identity among Christians that is based on hospitality and solidarity rather than hostility toward the other? What would such an identity look like? Of course, that kind of dream goes back to the ancient Hebrew prophets with the dream of the lion lying down with the lamb. Listen, I don't think Isaiah was concerned about relationships among mammals. That's a way to talk about predatory people, not preying upon vulnerable people. That's about human society, not about the rest of the animal kingdom. So as I grappled with this over the years, I identified five challenges that I think we Christians have to address if we're going to change our identity and find this third alternative between a weak and tolerant, a strong and hostile, to find a strong and benevolent identity. Five challenges: historical, doctrinal, liturgical, missional, and spiritual. Now, I need to tell you, I wrote about the spiritual challenge in a book called Naked Spirituality. And if you ever decide to read that book, you'll notice that it begins and ends with the story of St. Francis. And St. Francis is one of the Christian heroes who stands out as a man of benevolence toward the religiously other. No question about the strength of his own commitment, but his commitment sent him with open hands to the other. So I talked about that spirituality in that book. And in this book, I talked about these first four problems. And I wish I had time to talk about all four. We could talk about Christian history that almost all Christians are ignorant of. The Christian history, for example, for those of us from a Catholic background, Christian history that's seldom talked about, like when some popes in the Middle Ages sent out Cortez and Columbus and others with a carte blanche because they were Christians. They gave them permission to kill and enslave and steal the lands of the indigenous peoples. And the Holocaust that resulted from that permission will never be fully known, because the people died by the millions, some from disease, some from being driven from their lands, and some literally by the sword and by the gun. And the results were devastating. There was a dialogue that took place over 150 years among Roman Catholics in Latin America when the first few started raising their voice and say, these are human beings too. Jesus told us to love our neighbor as ourselves. They're our neighbors. You shouldn't rape and kill and steal the lands and enslave your neighbors, right? But listen, we can say that South America. North America, we had the same story. And this time it was Protestants who came over fleeing religious persecution only to become the persecutors of the native peoples here. And this was theologically justified, and it was the writings of John Calvin and others that had the same effect for the Protestants as a papal document had for the Catholics. And of course, behind all this was the African slave trade. 13 million people, the ancestors of some of us in this room, who were kidnapped from Africa. And Bible verses were used to justify it from beginning to end. This is part of our history. And when you have a religion that has history like this, it leaves a residue, even among the grandchildren and great-grandchildren of the perpetrators of the atrocities. It leaves a residue, and they don't even have to know about the history to suffer from the residue. Does that make sense? This is, those of us who are together, I mentioned this earlier, there's a powerful scene in the movie 12 Years a Slave, which if you haven't seen, Americans need to see this movie because it tells us the truth about the racism in our nation's past. White people especially need to see this movie. And there's a scene where a white character says, who is a slave master, a foreman, says He says, you don't do what I've done without it affecting you. And so we're still coming to terms with the effects of this. And the Christian faith was, this was not accidental. We wouldn't even have to deal with America. We could go to South Africa. We could talk about apartheid. A lot of people don't know. Apartheid was created in a seminary. And it was a theological project. So, and of course, can we be honest? What's going on in American politics today? Christian theology fuels a lot of wild and crazy things today. So we've got to learn about our history. And when we do, it will then make us want to pay attention to these other areas. But what I'd like to talk about this evening for a few minutes is the doctrinal question. Because one of the reasons why Christians often begin to decaffeinate and dilute and water down their faith is this fear that doctrinal distinctives will always create tensions. And another a psychologist named Jonathan Haidt reminds us that there is this survival value in forming a sacred group identity. And it actually it helped our ancestors in various ways. We can imagine people circling around a rock or a tree or an idol and getting a sense of we're the holy people. We're connected in a very deep way. And that cohesiveness giving them a survival advantage. But the fact is that kind of sacred groupishness could actually involve doctrines. It doesn't have to involve a physical idol. It could involve a set of doctrines. Have you ever had this experience? I bet I've had this happen 20 times in my life where I'm walking across a parking lot and somebody comes up to me with a leaflet. And do you know where this is going? And he wants to hand me a leaflet to tell me how not to go to hell. And I he'll say, what religion are you? And I'll say, well, I'm a Christian. What denominate? Are you a born-again Christian? Are you a spirit-filled born-again Christian? Are you a premillennial spirit-filled? And you get the feeling he keeps asking you questions till he can find something that you're wrong about so that he can make you an outsider who he is going to enlighten because that's the kind of relationship he or she wants to have with you. And you realize that these doctrines become, if you speak the lingo, then you belong to the same group. Conservatives do it with their set of rules. Liberals do it with their set of rules. We all find ways to have these loyalty tests. But doctrine, the word doctrine can have another meaning. The word doctrine etymologically is related to the word doctor. And the original idea in that etymology is that a doctrine is a healing teaching. It's the kind of teaching that helps us with our wounds and diseases and divisions and scars. And could we take a look at our doctrines and could we rediscover them, not as centering idols, but as healing teachings that can actually help reconnect, re-ligament what has been dislocated and torn apart. So what I'd like to do in 15 minutes or so, and then we'll open up for some questions. I'd like to just name several doctrines that have a checkered past in the way they've been used by Christians to harm others. And I'd like to briefly mention how they harm others and then talk about how instead of throwing the doctrine out, we could actually kind of hold it up to the light and look at it in a different light. And it actually could help us in encountering the other rather than being used as a weapon. First is the healing teaching of creation. Whenever American Christians say the word creation, they almost always then think of the word versus, and then they think evolution. So we have this weird history. A lot of other places in the world don't have this, although we do our best to export it, of creating this creation versus evolution debate. So you say creation, and immediately a whole bunch of us have hostility towards science. But have you ever thought that the doctrine of creation actually could function in a very different way when it comes to multi-religious identity? The doctrine of creation says we all have the same ancient history. It says that we all are ultimately related. We're related through God to one another, and we're biologically related. Not only that, which is a big deal. It means that the Christian and the Muslim are cousins. And we've got to understand our relatedness and our connectedness. But it also means that we're related to the fish of the sea and the birds of the air and the trees of the field. We're all related. We're made of the same. Of course, it was Ash Wednesday this week, and we're told in church that we're made of dust. And the astronomers tell us, yeah, that's true. It's stardust. You know, that we actually have an evolutionary history where every atom in your body was part of a supernova that eventually recoalesced. And you know, we're sharing atoms all the time, and we're recycling, and we're all connected. We're really part of the same creation. The doctrine of creation tells us that. Now, if there is a doctrine that is responsible for deaths in large numbers, one of the doctrines is the doctrine of original sin. The traditional accounting of this says that when Adam and Eve did something wrong and went from a state of perfection to imperfection, they entered a state of damnation. The famous American Puritan preacher Jonathan Edwards depicted this very graphically to say that when you're in a state of damnation, God finds you repulsive. You are like a disgusting spider that's hanging on a web over a fire. And what God would really like to do is just let you fall. And so your idea is that God's deepest disposition toward all humanity is disgust and revulsion because of our imperfection. But a few people are given an exemption. And so... you can see what this does psychologically. If you're one of the people who's given an exemption, then you and God are up here looking down on all the other people who are damned. It's a whole lot easier to steal people's lands, to oppress them, to exclude them, to put them in ghettos and concentration camps and reservations. It's way easier to do all that if they're damned and cursed by God. You're, in a sense, just joining God. Things are going to get a lot worse for them. You're doing them a favor, in a sense, just forestalling a much worse fate that's going to come from God. I mean, that's how this doctrine has been used in history. It could be abused. It has been abused in this way. So a lot of people say, let's get rid of that one. Try this on, though. If you go back and read the Genesis story, remember Eve takes the fruit. Do you remember what the snake says to Eve? The snake says, if you take that fruit, you will be as gods. Now look, there are many interpretations of the story, but try this one on. What do gods in the ancient world have the power to do? Give life and take life. You will be as gods. You will get to decide who lives and who dies. You remember it's called the tree of knowledge of good and evil? We always interpret that in abstract, ontological, philosophical sort of categories. What if it actually means you're given the right to say, he's evil, he'll die. She's good, she'll live. You know, that we're making the decision to be like gods and decide who gets to live, who gets to die, who gets to be exterminated, and who gets to be preserved. So if Eve reaching for the fruit, that represents the desire to have godlike power, and Adam joins in that, what would we expect to flow from their decision? Well, we might expect violence to flow from their decision. What's the next story? Cain and Abel. And Cain and Abel have, in a certain sense, a religious dispute, and Cain decides he can kill Abel. It's what if the original sin is the desire to be like gods and to get to judge everybody else and their value? What if that's the original sin? Suddenly now, if you understand original sin that way, instead of using it to condemn others, it becomes a mirror that makes us acknowledge our own complicity in violence. Suddenly it becomes not a weapon, but a healing teaching. One of the other doctrines, horrible history, is the doctrine of election. not meaning like 2016, but the idea that God chooses some people and not other people. And a great British missiologist named Leslie Newbegin, who spent his life in India and had to live with religious pluralism, he said it this way: the greatest heresy in the history of monotheism is a misunderstanding of election, thinking that election is being chosen for exclusive privilege. He says that's the greatest heresy in the history of monotheism. I'll tell you when I really understand this. It's when I look back at my childhood and I remember the experience of being chosen as a safety patrol. Do we have any other safety patrols in the room? Hold your hands high. Do they still have safety patrols in Wisconsin? Okay, so, you know, I was in fifth grade. I still remember my teacher, Miss Greer. She said, we're going to choose some lucky fifth graders to be safety patrols. And I thought, I know what safety patrols are. They get to wear this cool belt. Back in those days, they were white. Now they're like neon orange and stuff. But they were this way. And then you had a badge like a sheriff. And the badge had AAA on it. I didn't know there was something called the American Automobile Association. I thought this was a, like, you were being assessed as a triple A child. I thought, that would do me some good, you know. And I knew that if you were safety patrol, you could come to class 15 minutes late, leave class 15 minutes early, and you got an all-expense-paid trip to an amusement park in June at the end of the school year. And I remember when she said, who would like to be a safety patrol? You know, it was like, of course, and I got chosen. And I found out I had to show up 45 minutes early, and I had to stay 30 minutes late. And yeah, it was nice to go to amusement park, but you had to deal with fourth graders for the whole year who are really obnoxious. And so I found out, I thought I was being chosen for privilege. I was actually being chosen for suffering and service. And Leslie Newbegin says, to be chosen by God is not being chosen for membership in the country club. It's being chosen to be a safety patrol. It's being chosen to be a servant. It's being chosen to suffer, to sacrifice on behalf of others. What would have happened if the early colonists who came from England to the Netherlands here, what would have happened if they encountered the native peoples of North America, not saying, we're the elect and they're the damned, but saying, we've been chosen by God to be servants to our neighbors? Would have been a different history. Healing teaching of the incarnation. The idea that when we look at Jesus, we see what God is like. I heard someone mention earlier the great Quaker theologian, Elton Trueblood. Elton Trueblood described this so perfectly. He said, the doctrine of the incarnation is not intended to mean that we take a definition of God, a pre-existing definition of God, and then we take Jesus, and then we lift Jesus up to that definition of God. He says, no. The doctrine of the incarnation says we have all these pre-existing ideas of God. Jesus comes along, and we have to rethink all of our definitions of God in light of Jesus. Who is Jesus? He is a man of peace who did not kill anyone, who would rather suffer than cause suffering for others. And when you have to adjust your view of God in light of Jesus, everything changes. Wow. Suddenly that doctrine could revolutionize everything for us as Christians. Closely related to it is this idea of the deity of Christ, and closely related to that is the doctrine of the Holy Spirit, and closely related to that is the doctrine of the Trinity. Now, I'll tell you, if you've studied the history of Christian anti-Semitism, you can see why any Jew would want to get up and walk out of the room when he hears the word Trinity, because the word was used as a weapon against the Jews for so much of European history. And it just makes you sick when you read about this part of Christian history. But the doctrine of the Trinity suggests that, try this on, this is really quite amazing, that in God, there is fatherness. Now remember, In a patriarchal world where a lot of our language about God comes from, fathers are dominant and everybody else is subservient. The very nature of fatherhood is that it's a position of power. But the doctrine of the Trinity says in God there is fatherness that does not subordinate sonness, but elevate sonness to equality with fatherness. And there's fatherness and sonness that doesn't subordinate spiritness in God, but that elevates spirit and acknowledges spirit as equal to father and son, and that they're in this divine unity, there is diversity. That God is unity and diversity in harmony. Suddenly, the doctrine of the Trinity says to practice Trinity requires otherness and requires a unity that isn't based on homogeneity, but it's unity that arises and lives and subsists within diversity. It's a pretty remarkable concept if we move beyond the way it's been used as a weapon. Doctrine of the Holy Spirit. The idea that there is, that God's Spirit is somehow present in creation. Remember in the book of Genesis, the Spirit was hovering over the waters. That in a sense, the Spirit's presence is, the Spirit is present in creation before there are any people, before there are any living creatures, certainly before there are any religions. So the Spirit is more pervasive and more primal than any religion. If that's the case, a great Pentecostal theologian, living Pentecostal theologian named Amos Young, suggests that every Christian encounter with people of other religions should be an encounter of giving and receiving, because we should expect that everyone has been encountering the Spirit in their own locale, and they should have something to say to us about their encounter with the Spirit, who is ubiquitous in creation. It's quite remarkable. And of course, underlying all of this, huge struggle for Christians is how do we understand this, the inspiration of Scripture? And one of the most exciting things that's happening in biblical studies is that we're starting to understand that Scripture is not a univocal, it's not a flat text. Scripture is a rip-roaring, raucous argument among different people who care about the same things and see them differently and have vital, necessary, needed arguments. In fact, there's a theologian who defines a culture as a group of people who are united by an argument. And if you think about it, Western civilization, we've been united by an argument since the time of the Greeks about the one and the many. By the way, can you see how when the doctrine of the Trinity arises in the Western church, it takes place within the context of this argument about the one and the many? It's really quite a brilliant idea that the one and the many can coexist. It's quite a big deal in Western civilization. The Eastern church conceived of the Trinity in quite different ways in some ways, because they weren't part of that same argument in exactly the same way. There were other arguments going on as well. But if we went to China, the argument in ancient Chinese history wasn't so much the one and the many. It was the rights of the dead versus the rights of the living. And that's a very different argument. Confucius is, that's part of that whole tradition. That was an argument that people are still grappling with today. If we were with some of the Native American tribes, they had a completely different argument. They weren't thinking about the one and the many, or they were thinking about the rights of the living in relation to the rights of the not yet living. So cultures are brought together by arguments, and the Bible gives us a set of documents, a library that keeps these arguments alive and helps us understand that revelation doesn't emerge from one person telling you what to think, but it emerges from conversations, point and counterpoint, that revelation emerges in the midst of that. Well, if that's how you understand Scripture, it has you, brings you into an encounter with the other in a very, very different way. So you put all those together, and I think we can get some idea then of how our doctrines can be rediscovered as healing teachings. And what we need to do is just help people hold them in a more charitable and generous and loving way. Hold them even more strongly, but in a different way. One quick anecdote, then we'll open up for some questions. Many of you would know the name Eboo Patel. Eboo is a wonderful interfaith worker, Muslim, Ismaili Muslim. And he's written some great books, Sacred Ground, and does anybody remember his other more recent book? Anyway, really good, and I've just forgotten the title of the more recent one. But Eboo and I, the first time we met, we had one of those conversations in a restaurant or indoors somewhere. And then, you know how when you keep talking all the way out to the parking lot, and then you walk over to one person's car and you keep talking, then you walk to the other person's car and you keep talking, and you just sort of are late for your next appointment, and we were just having this kind of a conversation. I said, Eboo, you Muslims have a big advantage over us Christians when it comes to interfaith relations. He says, what do you mean? I said, whenever I talk to a Muslim about interfaith relations, they quote the verse from the Quran, we made you different so you would seek to understand each other. I said, man, that's a great verse for interfaith relations. Whenever you talk to a Christian, they quote John 14:6. Jesus said, I am the way, the truth, and the life. No one comes to the Father but by me, you know. And Eboo just started laughing. He said, first of all, Brian, believe me, there are other verses from the Quran that could be quoted that wouldn't be as friendly as that one. He says, but that's the real question, isn't it? Why have you Christians been taught to quote John 14:6 and Muslims have been taught to quote this surah? Why have your teachers told you that that's the verse to quote? He said, I'm sure you could find some better verses to quote. And I started thinking about it. Thought about, yeah, what if instead of every time people say, what about people of other religions? We were taught to quote 1 John chapter 4. Beloved, let us love one another. For love is of God, and everyone who loves is born of God and knows God, for God is love. It'd be a whole different ballgame if that was the verse we got taught to quote. And so Eboo's question, here's what he said. If you've been taught to quote one verse, you could be retaught to see things in a different way. And this to me is our opportunity as Christians. This could be the last generation of Christian hostility if enough of us get together and say, let's teach our children and grandchildren a new way of holding our own identity so we can relate to people of other identities. Thanks very much.
So we have a little bit of time for questions for Brian, and the way we like to do this is somebody raise their hand, and I will bring them the microphone.
Thanks. I appreciate deeply your commentary and your views about doctrine and the reconciliation of being held to doctrinal beliefs firmly and still have tolerance of others. Question I want to put to you is this. How do you integrate your appeal to reformation, if you want to call it that, of doctrine with the context in which religion is functioning? As an historian and a psychologist, both, I'm talking about issues of nationalism. I'm talking about issues of very strong forces, money, that operate on their own dynamic, outside of the doctrine. And I wonder how you confront that, because certainly what you have to say about doctrine, to me, is it's a wonderful message.
But you're bringing up something really important. And I promise I'm going to answer it, but let me do it sort of sideways, okay? Because your question points out or brings to mind something we hear a lot of people say, which is wars are started by religion. And that's really true. Religion is a component in so many wars. But we could also say wars are caused by government. Wars are caused by patriotism. Wars are caused by loyalty to your family. So we realize that this is a human problem that shows up in politics and religion. Wars are caused by social class and wealth. So what we'd have to say is this is a human problem of hostility that probably had survival value in our past. We might be almost evolutionarily hardwired for it. If not, our cultural evolution is wired for it. And we have, and it pops up in all these different domains of life. So, but it really does pop up in religion. And then we have to face the way that religion becomes the tool of government or the tool of economics or the tool of all kinds of demagoguery to mobilize people for hostility, for profit, and so on. And as soon as we bring that up, I'll just speak as a Christian in the biblical tradition. You open the Bible and suddenly you say, oh yeah, this is what they're arguing about in the Bible. For example, one of the big arguments in the Hebrew scriptures is between those who say we really need a king and those who say a king is the worst thing that could happen to us. We should stay with the more primitive or original organization of warlords. They were called judges in the Bible, but warlords or kings. And each side had, you know, some strengths and weaknesses in this. But you realize, wow, there's a battle there. You imagine Jesus walking into the temple saying, you've taken what's supposed to be a house of prayer and you've turned it into a den of thieves. Wow, money has corrupted this thing. You imagine Jesus being asked, what about paying taxes to Caesar? Give to Caesar what does Caesar say? So there's this tension between politics and economics and religion. And it is an age-old tension. And we're probably in the most trouble when we're not aware of the tension. And I think your question really points up the tension. But here's maybe something I would say is part of our challenge in the midst. If we acknowledge that if religion disappeared tomorrow, the problem of hostility would not go away. We would have denominations of atheism fighting against each other over politics and money and race and any number of other things. I mean, this is a human problem. And in this way, here's a way to say it. If religion could be expunged from our vocabulary and we got rid of them all, kind of like the Soviet Union and Maoist China tried to do, get rid of religion because then we won't have these hostilities. We'd have to say, well, who is going to teach us the skills of peace building? Who's going to teach us the skills of reconciliation? Who's going to teach us how to have interior impulse and desire control so that we don't end up in aggressive rivalry with one another? Pretty soon, you're going to have to, who's going to teach us principles of justice so that people can be treated fairly and aren't abused and live with offense that they have to get retaliation for and so on? As soon as you start saying, who's going to do that, you're going to envision something that's what religion was supposed to fulfill. And I think this is one of our opportunities in this moment when it looks like our religions are failing us. Christians, Muslims, Jews, Hindus, Buddhists, atheists, Sikhs, you know, around the gamut, we start saying, we need somebody who does a really good job of teaching us these set of skills we need for harmonious collaboration and coexistence. And that, it just seems to me we have no option. We have to try for that. And that's kind of where I'd say we are. But this, the concern about how religion itself then becomes the tool of these other forces, it's really valid to bring that up. So thank you.
Thank you for opening up our minds. I appreciate sometimes loosening the reins is a great opportunity for our faith. As you were talking about the Trinity being a divisive concept between Jews and Christians, I was looking behind you to notice the symbol of the cross. And I wonder if you would consider the cross also being one of those symbols that doesn't completely identify with what a life of faith is of a Christian. Yes. It is a single symbol, but it doesn't complete the story really for us in modern Christianity. So if we remove the cross, it might be very difficult for a lot of Christians because we hold it dear. But let me suggest that if Jesus were here today and were convicted and died in an electric chair, would that be an electric chair? Yeah. And how weird would it be to have an electric chair around my neck? Yeah. And how weird would it be for other religions to see this guy walking around with an electric chair around his neck and say, that's your symbol of your God?
Yeah.
How absurd is that idea? So just a thought.
Yes. Well, first of all, that's extremely important one to bring up. And in the book, I deal with this in two chapters, but the main chapter where I deal with this is actually the chapter on Eucharist. Because Eucharist becomes one of the places where we ritually bond to our the understanding we have of what the meaning of the cross is. And I really, I think you're bringing up an extremely important issue. I wonder if I could take, it's always a bad idea to do this after 8 p.m., to talk about some serious theology after 8 p.m., but I'm going to try to do it as well as I can and as briefly as I can. But what you're talking about when you mention the cross is a field of Christian theology often called atonement theology. And actually, we have right here in the room Denny Weaver, who is one of the first people, a Mennonite theologian, one of the first people to really get this issue on the table. And his writings have really helped me. And there's a revolution going on in this. And if I can say it this way, for a lot of people, what the cross represents is it is like an altar upon which Jesus is sacrificed to appease an angry God. If I can say it very bluntly, it's that's what the cross means. And every time people look at a cross, it reinforces their idea that there is an angry God whose fury must be appeased. And this relates to what I was saying earlier about original sin. And the good news of Christianity is understood as God was successfully appeased. Successfully on behalf of some people. It doesn't work out so well for others. But that's the meaning of the cross. And when people understand that as the meaning of the cross, I am very sympathetic when they want to say, the cross should not be our primary symbol. Our primary symbol should either be the bread and cup as a symbol of a shared meal, or maybe the basin and towel as a symbol of service toward others. But I'll tell you what I think is true. Now, whether this is easy to convince people of or not is another story, but I actually believe this is true. Here's what I think is really behind the meaning of the cross in the New Testament. It requires us to know something that isn't from the New Testament. And it isn't from the Hebrew Scriptures. It's from Roman politics. In the first century BC, I know it's very hard for us to imagine a government that's deeply divided where the Senate can't get anything done. And I know it's very hard for us to imagine this. But this was the problem back in the first century BC. And there was a fellow who came along who became known later as Caesar Augustus. And the word Augustus means worthy of worship. It means worshipped Caesar, you know, a Caesar to worship. And he came along and he successfully unified a disintegrating Roman Empire or deeply divided Roman Empire. And he did it with a new technology of torture. And that technology of torture was the cross. And the way he did it is he was willing to publicly torture people to a degree that was unprecedented and that was regularized and that was predictable. And it basically went like this. If you dare to defy the power of Caesar over the whole Roman Empire, then we will put you on one of those things and you will hang there for a few days, because doing it with nails wasn't always the way it was done. It was often done just to be exposed to the elements. And as people watch you go from being a mighty rebel to a crying, whimpering, a terrified victim of torture, calling for your mama with feces dripping down your legs and tears dripping down your face. When people see that, they'll know this is what happens to people who try to defy Caesar. And that torture technology and everything that would go along with it created unity in the Roman Empire, law and order that was so great that it made people say that Caesar is worthy of worship. And this was such a great thing for everybody except the people who were under the heel of that Roman Empire. So for Jesus to be willing to go to a cross and say, I'm going to be nonviolent right up to my own execution, and to be a good man who, pardon me saying it this way, but he dispensed free health care. he cared for the poor. He cared for people who everybody else made outcasts. And obviously a good man that even his enemies or critics were willing to say, God is with this guy. That when the Romans do this to that kind of person, you are forced to either discredit the victim or discredit the perpetrator. And the discrediting of Caesar takes the cross from his symbol of power to the sign of his unmasking as a dictator, right? When that happens, the meaning of the cross now is reversed. And politically, its meaning is reversed. And I believe that's why it was a symbol for the early Christians. But here's the tragedy. You only go ahead a few centuries, and you get to the story of Constantine, who's faced with a divided Roman Empire. And he reappropriates the cross as a symbol of violence and hoodwinks the bishops into backing him in that process. So this is why it's so good for you to bring this up. The cross today is a symbol that had original meaning, its meaning was reversed, and then it was reversed again. And you can never tell when a Christian has a cross around their neck or on their building which meaning of the cross they're bound to. And even more deeply, which understanding of God lies behind that understanding of the cross. Now, it's late, so if that puts you to sleep, but I'll tell you, that is an important issue that you're raising. And I think the Christian faith is in the process of re-examining its atonement theology. And we're at a very, very exciting moment. And I think core to a strong and benevolent faith is that kind of rethinking of the cross that you've raised for us. So thanks very much. Do we have time for another?
One more, yeah.
One more question.
Just to kind of reiterate what you were saying about atonement.
Yeah.
The way that I, in my Roman Catholic tradition, believes it's at one with.
Yes.
As opposed to having to...
Appease. Yes.
So that's just kind of what I wanted to offer. At one with.
For Jesus to come and say, God loves you. Any problem between you and God is not God's, it's yours. And if you want to repent, God is there waiting for you. That's really good news. It's really good news. And unfortunately, we got hoodwinked into saying that the real meaning of that story is God is not for you. God does not love you unless you get the exemption card. So this is where we really have some reverse work. And I'm really encouraged that you say that as a Roman Catholic, because this doctrine didn't exist in Christian history in its current form until well after 1100 or so. And so the Catholic Church had a long history before this way of understanding the cross really came to the fore, and then has become for some Protestants their primary understanding of the cross and of God and so on. But what's interesting is there's always been a minority opinion in Catholicism and among Protestants. And there's a really interesting thing happens when Protestants and Catholics who are Western Christians go talk to Eastern Orthodox, who always, they never really got this Western Christian obsession with this sort of thing. And what you just said really sounds like something an Eastern Orthodox person would say as well. So it's just a reminder to us that we aren't stuck where we are. We really can change over time. So
you mentioned the issue of Scripture without going on about it, but I would like to make one point that was made to me many years ago, and it is that the way you decide on what is in the Bible and what is not in it is to study the Council of Nicaea from 320 AD, and then you see that there were several books that just didn't make it, that the vote of the council left them out, and others that just barely made it in. And if you're going to believe that the Bible, as we have it now, is inspired in its totality, then you have to believe that the Council of Nicaea was where the Spirit was really working.
Yeah, and what's really interesting is for Protestants, Martin Luther wasn't afraid to say they made a mistake. They included two that they shouldn't have, and maybe more. So it's just a reminder to us that everything is contestable, isn't it? But I'll tell you, something is happening in biblical studies right now. And something is happening among rank-and-file Christians that when they're given another way of seeing the Bible, instead of in this sort of flat, what I call a constitutional reading of the Bible, what they're given, is what people are ready for. It's like people are ready for this and the clergy are afraid to give it to them. Some people are ready, some people aren't. But they're ready to be given a complex scripture where a lot is going on. But here's the problem for preachers like, you know, me. We've got simplistic preachers. My friend Diana Butler Bass says, why are our only two choices ignorance on fire and intelligence on ice? But we have some preachers who are very simplistic in their use of the Bible. And then we have other preachers who are very sophisticated in their kind of demythologizing of the Bible. These people end up without a lot of, if I can say it this way, without a lot of intelligence and with a lot of meaning. These people end up with a lot of intelligence and without much meaning. To me, the real job is, how can we go through that deconstruction process and then rediscover the meaning? And how can we start celebrating that meaning? And this is what's really at the root of this. And here's what to me is very exciting and what we'll discuss in our panel in just a couple of minutes. I hope we'll discuss in our meeting. But when you say that religions are meaning-making ventures, then you realize, as the brilliant Methodist theologian John Cobb says, that all religions are in the making, meaning they're all in process. They're evolving too. Then we suddenly can look and say, we need meaning that will be a healing teaching for us as we move forward. And it's the kind of people who show up on a Saturday night like this who are people who will participate in that meaning-making venture. We're all in this together. Amen?